League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and today is another special. Today's conversation is with Gizzy Erskine, who is a chef, and she's had a really interesting, well, TV personality as well, I suppose, and she's had a really interesting life. There's quite a lot to her. What did you know about Gizzy before she came in today?
I'll be honest, apart from the fact that she was a chef, zero.
And what do you think now? Quite a colourful life.
She's so cool. She's
very awesome.
Very cool.
So we talk a lot about...
open and honest interview.
Really open.
Really great, wasn't it?
Oh, I loved it. Really enjoyed it. I know her because she comes on Sunday brunch.
Right.
And she's just always lovely. We have such a lovely conversation together always. And she's just a really nice person. And, you know, that goes a long way. But she's got a very colourful past.
And she invited us to the restaurant.
Yes, definitely going to go to the restaurant. But there's more to this interview than just, or this conversation than just talking about food. We talk about piercings. And
you use a word I never thought I'd hear you use before.
I didn't know what to say.
On several occasions.
I didn't know which words to use. It was really...
On
TV, it's really weird. Yeah, on TV you don't use any words. So it was awkward. So yeah.
And she also been diagnosed with
ADHD.
Yes.
Yep, and anxiety. So she talks a lot about that. Yeah, so there's a lot to get your teeth into. I hope you enjoy it. And anyway, here she is, live from my kitchen, Gizzy. Oh, by the way, we filmed it again.
Yeah.
So if you are listening to this and you do want to go back and look at the pictures, because we do talk about a few things, head to my Twitter page, or just go to YouTube and search Dear Lovejoy.
And you can see the tiny present that Tim bought. Microscopic. It's really good because they've got a zoom on those cameras, so I could really go.
Right, whatever. Here you go. Learn all about the present right now. It's live from my kitchen, Gizzy Erskine.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does... right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast. Hello, everyone who's watching us online. We're now on YouTube as well. Today is my guest is a chef first, a TV personality second.
Yeah.
Gizzy Erskine, thank you very much for coming in today. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm good.
Like everybody, I buy all my guests a present. I've got your present, but I feel so bad about it now. I went into a shop.
Right.
And it was a really cool, trendy shop. And they had all these plants there, which are called, I'm going to say this wrong, Achivery plants. Anyway, they're from Mexico and South America. People would be laughing at me now because of the pronunciation of the plants. And they said these are really cool. Then I was looking around and I found one which had such a cool little plant pot that I thought, that is perfect. I'm going to get that for Gizzy. But then on the train on the way home, I looked at it and it looks so cheap and nasty that I've got absolute guilt from it. Because the plant, it looks like something you get in a school fete or something.
It's amazing. What are you talking about?
But I love the little plant
pot.
It's
so great.
It's got vintage on it. And I thought, that's
vintage,
so good.
It's so me.
But the plant should be big and lovely, and it's just a tiny wee
plant.
No,
it's actually really cool. And I feel like I might not be able to kill this, which is a perk. I'm like the world's worst gardener.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's amazing.
Absolute pleasure. So how's the restaurant going? Because I don't think I've seen you much since you've opened up your restaurant.
No, pretty much since, for the last year, I've been completely focused on that. And it's amazing. We opened just over 2 months ago. It's not just a restaurant. I think we've sort of been describing it because within it, I'm going to have my first real, real restaurant. But it's actually a huge food space. It's a market. It's 12,000 square foot. You walk in, we've got a huge food store and deli in there. We're roasting our own coffee. We've got our own off license. We've got Rebel Rebel doing the flowers. We've got, you must know, do you know Rough Trade?
Yeah.
So Noreen from Rough Trade, she's opened up her first record shop, Stranger Than Paradise. We've got a podcast station, huge central bar, and a pop-up shop. And then we got my restaurant, which hasn't opened yet because we're totally... We sort of hit the ground running pretty much the second we opened to queues. And our main part of it is a huge central bar, a bit like one of those markets that you get in Europe. And we've been sort of knocking out a good few hundred, coming up to thousands of covers by the time we hit the weekend every day. And it's just meant we can't actually open the restaurant.
Right.
So it's really, it's amazing. It's sort of like the best problem you could ever want to have as a business person, but it's just completely changed the nature of what we set out to do, really.
Do you know what? It just sounds so you, though.
It would really be
something mad like that with so many different things going on. I must apologize. I've not been there yet, and I feel bad about that. But so what food are you doing? Are you doing the food? Are you designing the food?
Yeah, there? So I'm sort of like a co-founder and creator and creative director, I guess. So I'm co-execing as a chef on the whole thing. But because there's loads of different food spaces, I guess it would be impossible to actually chef out of all of them, really.
Yeah.
So I've got a brilliant guy, Phil Smith, who's my head chef, and we launched with Tim Morn, who's up Caprice Holdings, really. And he sort of helped launch it with us. And the main bit is called the Open Kitchen, and it's kind of like Californian inspired, but looking back to the Alice Waters sort of style of like Los Angeles cooking, sort of from way back 70s.
I don't know what that is.
It's real sort of farm to table movement, I guess. Loads of incredible cool salads that have got really good produce in them. We've got really great rotisserie chicken. It's just really simple but elegant food. I mean, this is the bar food. So by the time we actually get to open up the restaurant, which is going to be sort of like French classics, but with a bit of a British twist to it, I guess. And then like next month, we've got Fetty Sal coming over from Brooklyn, who are going to be doing a massive pop-up, which is like all barbecue-led in our outdoor area. And so there's like, it's constantly moving. It's really, really cool space. And the food is fantastic. I mean, I'm so proud of everyone who's been working for us.
So who are you doing it with?
It's a guy called Mark Francis Baum. He's Barworks.
Right.
And he's got loads of businesses. And he's like a brilliant, he's a brilliant mind. And he's a really like naughty, fun guy to work with.
So how did the concept come together? Did you go to him, or did he come to you, or was it a meeting of minds?
It's quite weird. Like I'm also one of the founder members of London Union, which have Street Feast. And so me and JD, Jonathan Downey, who own Street Feast, we were going to be setting up something very similar, and with Henry Dibbleby as well. And then I got really busy. I was working in Korea and India, and I was like filming basically all over the world, and it sort of fizzled out a bit. But I guess the sort of essence of it was still there. And Mark was doing this project. He'd like secured the space, which is in Hackney. It's in Mare Street. It's called Mare Street Market, actually. I should have said that. And so he found the space, and he was working with initially with someone else, and that sort of fell through. And then he'd heard word on the street that I was doing this other thing. And then we just sat down. It was just one of those weird things. I was driving, I was going off to a meeting, and as I was driving past the site, and Mark was there, and he phoned me, and I literally just jumped out the cab and went over and met him, and we just sort of like bonded. It was like a proper meeting of minds.
So what are the mistakes you've made so far then? Because, you know, you've said it's brilliant and people are queuing up and everyone wants to go to it, but you must have made some mistakes.
Oh God, constantly. You know, I mean, it's literally, it goes from being like a real creative idea to spending the half of your day troubleshooting or running around for like fixing things. I couldn't even like put my finger on one specific mistake. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of it's people managing. It's a very hard project to run because we are doing such big covers, and despite the kitchen being huge, a lot bigger than most kitchens, it's still, you know, it's still very hard. And when we're in sort of peak times, I mean, as a cook and as a chef, you know, you're in the midst of that. It's chaos, and I really feel for those guys.
Do you know, I must say this is the weirdest podcast ever because we are genuinely doing it from my kitchen. This is where I live.
Amazing.
The cat comes in and she's got one of those chips in her, so you hear that bleeping off. The next door neighbour's having the garden done.
it's really
we hear that. We usually get someone knocking at the door halfway through at the postman or something.
It's
at the delivery.
Brilliant. I'm actually obsessed with your cat though.
She's cute.
Yeah, we've got very similar cats. It's
British short hair.
Yeah, well I've got British short hair, Kimchi. Yeah. And I've also got a Scottish Fold, which is more like yours. So he's got the foldy ears.
Right. Mine's pretty short hair. Yeah. Kimchi, that's a good name.
Yeah, kimchi.
It's become so fashionable, kimchi, hasn't it?
I know.
Fermented food. But the stuff you're selling is not health food, is it? It's proper food.
No, not in this one. I mean, it is proper food. I mean, all of the food we do is proper. I mean, you know, in the deli, we've got a fromagerie, we've got a charcuterie space. We're doing like, it's proper food.
Yeah.
But I am opening up.
You're opening up.
I'm opening up in September. I'm going to be opening our first site of Pure Filth, which is in Victoria, in the old Pasha site, which is ironic because apparently there was a club night called Pure Filth back in the day.
Okay.
That's sort of, it's like a vegetarian ethical burger chain, not vegan, but it's really, really high quality, highly nutritious, really clever technology, which is a weird thing to associate with food, but we created a burger.
The demand for that stuff is amazing. Yeah. Now, the vegetarian, the vegan food. Yeah. I must say though, I've tasted your food a lot and it's great stuff you do. You do proper food as well. Not that that's not proper food. but it's funny because on Sunday brunch, the big stuff we get, the cat's meowing now. The really big impact we have is always sort of things like pulled pork or ultimate burgers and stuff. People love that barbecued stuff.
Yep.
And then when you get the, you know, we're going to make a dessert with avocado rather than cream, people will be like,
yeah. Yeah, totally. Honestly, the most likes on Instagram I get are sausages.
Yeah.
You put a sausage up, everyone goes bananas for it.
Whenever a headline comes up in a paper that sausages and bacon and stuff like that is bad for you, I won't read it. I'm not reading that. I'll leave that to one side.
I mean, listen, it is bad for you if you eat too much of it. But if you're eating you're having a sausage every single day, it's not ideal. But if you're having it once a week, it's totally fine.
Are you employing the staff there? Are you actually doing?
This is my job now.
That hands on.
Yeah, I've given up. I sort of feel like I killed Gizzy Eskin off about 18 months ago. She was kind of annoying, and I really wanted to. Do you know what the truth is? It probably has sort of. I knew I was capable of much more than I was really giving out, and it's quite easy to get suckered into the world where you're getting paid a lot of money for doing really random stuff that it just wasn't making me happy. And I've been doing it for 10 years now. And so, it was just about time I just...
So you're talking about your TV career there. Yeah. So you're more excited now about being a business owner than a TV presenter?
I'm so much more satisfied. I'm poorer than I've ever been. and I'm way more exhausted, but it is so much more satisfying.
You now have a purpose in life.
Yeah, I feel like it's just a bit, you know, I guess I was... You know, being quite an outspoken, vocal woman as somebody who's like then suddenly realizes most of what they're getting paid for is to be the face of something. You're just like, oh, come on, man. You know, I have more to contribute to the world than what I was doing for a long time.
Yeah, I suppose your career took off massively. One of the reasons is because of your image and because of what you look like. You look different to other people doing your job, didn't you?
So I suppose
yeah, you did, didn't
no,
you?
I do,
and
so, I do, yeah.
So you know, I remember the first time I met you, I was like, "Wow, you look amazing with all your different hairdos and stuff like that." And I suppose that's quite an important thing when it comes to TV to have an image.
I guess so. I mean, I found it a bit of it's been a curse also as well, because it's meant that I've not been able to be taken as seriously as I guess I should have been. You know, what a lot of people don't realise was that I was actually a restaurant chef. I did actually win loads of awards, but prior to actually getting involved in telly, that's how I actually got recognised. I was one of the innovators of the whole pop-up restaurant scene 15 years ago. And all this stuff sort of almost gets swept aside because you look a bit weird and you're kind of attractive and, you know, and you've got a big gob. So I kind of, like, that was really, it sort of, you know, obviously I'm really lucky and privileged and I don't want to take away anything that, of these reasons why I've been successful for those things, and I've had some amazing experiences, and I still want to achieve those things eventually again, but I do feel like I was selling myself a bit short, I guess. Which is and it's weird now, you see so many people, I'm sure you have it as well, where you see so many people desperate to be on telly or desperate to be famous, you know, and it's just like, it ain't all that.
You know? I mean, no, but it pays my bills.
Yeah, so exactly. No, so sure,
I have,
but you know,
to keep doing it.
But you know, but you're a proper broadcaster. There is a difference.
I love doing my show because it's live.
Yeah.
And every time I do pre-recorded stuff, I'm a bit like, oh god, this is just so boring.
Yeah. Oh, and listen, you but do presenting live TV. Is a skill.
Yeah.
Like, I can't present. I'm hopeless. You're a really good presenter, and you're a real broadcaster. There is a difference.
Well, I don't know about that, but there you go.
Yeah.
Before we get into, I want to talk to you about that pop-up you've just mentioned, because that's interesting. That's been going for 15 years. But you say you employ staff. What do you look for when you, because I've employed staff before for production companies. Let's compare notes. What do you do? What do you look for?
I never look at CV. First of all,
nor have I
ever. Not so, once.
If you're doing your exams now, no point.
I mean, I never scored. 15.
No, there is, but yeah, go on.
I think it's about personality. It's about somebody who's go getting. It's like I like somebody who they don't have to be like hyper confident, but they walk in with and you feel secure in their knowledge, if that makes sense. Yeah. You know, I just want somebody who is a quick thinker and. You know,
I did a show called Soccer M. Do you remember when I did Soccer M? Yeah, all right, cool. So I employed everyone on that. I was the boss of that. I was the sort of producer, writer, and presenter. And the way I employed everyone was I sat down, I had a chat with them, and I thought, am I going to get on with this person?
Yeah.
And literally, I employed everyone by thinking, they're cool.
That's pretty much what I do.
And I like them, and I'm going to get on. And they look like they've got a brain, and they look like they've had. And so I created this team of people, and it just went on to be just so amazing.
Yeah.
A bit more through luck than judgment, they ended up coming from all over the country as well. So there's a real north-south thing. I told you.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is great. This is ridiculous. Yeah, Mark's going to run through camera shot now to go and get it. Thank you, Mark. It's nuts, this. Right, so tell us about the pop-up industry then, because you say 15 years old. We just think pop-ups have been around forever, but it wasn't, was it?
I guess there were events back in those days. When I first started doing it, it wasn't called a pop-up. You know, I was broke, I was at catering school, and we got offered a space in a gallery in Brick Lane, and somebody said, look, do you want to do something here? Because we've got this gallery launch, rather than going to somewhere where you have, like, white wine, like warm white wine and a few rubbish canapes. It's all kicking off behind.
I'm so sorry.
We decided to do like a long table event, cook, and then just say, you know, you can look at the art and then you can have some decent wine and pay what you want. And we never made a penny, but we got known and it became an actual event after a while. So everyone would come and see us sort of once a month. And then before we knew it, I was getting a sponsorship from brands and stuff. And that was really how I got discovered, I guess.
Right.
Because it was quite unusual. Like, nobody else was doing it. Back in those days, it was like Nuno Mendes, the guys at Bistro Tech, me, and Carl Clark, who has Disco Bistro and Chicken and Sours now.
Right.
So it's really cool to see how it's progressed. But now, like, the word pop-up to me makes me feel a bit cringe, you know.
Right. Sorry, Mark, just walking through shows. It's such a bizarre concept, this. Yeah, so the pop-up is just now seems to be the buzzword everywhere. But I think it's great that everyone's just turned their hand to it, though. Everyone's just going, come on, let's just do some food. And now we can go, I haven't got enough money to set up a restaurant, but I can set up a van somewhere or a table or something.
Absolutely.
And it's great, I think.
I mean, so, you know, you just got to look at the street food scene. You know, what Jonathan's done at Street Feast has been really interesting to see, you know, such small brands. People being given a tiny opportunity where they would never have been able to do that before.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing these big brands come out of it, and it's amazing.
And the restaurants are now reflecting street food as well, aren't they?
That to me is probably the worst thing that people can do, you know. It's like, you know, it's kind of like fashion, actually.
Yeah.
You see things coming up off the street, and then suddenly all these massive big designers do it. And it's like, but it's never going to be quite as authentic or as gritty as the real thing, you know?
Some of the other days said, where's the best meal you've ever had to me? And
I'm always interested. What is that?
Well, it's really bizarre concept, that, because if you're just talking food, then it would be one of those, you know, Michelin star type things. But that is not what I think is a good meal.
Same.
For the experience you want, you need food which is good, atmosphere which is brilliant, and clientele that you relate to. That's what I think, and great staff as well. You need all those elements. So if you go somewhere like, hopefully, Mere Street or something, and you've got people who are lovely and nice and they're buzzing and there's atmosphere and there's stuff going on, you go, I'm somewhere exciting, and it's, you know.
Absolutely. I also think that, you know, I mean, like, while I completely bow down to Michelin chefs because of the amount of effort that they spend working on, you know, to sort of refine their skill.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't always mean it is the best food, though. I feel the same as you. Like, I could sit at, you know, some of the best food I've had has been, you know, with my family in Spain, you know, having really delicious paella on the beach, you know, that to me is like far more exciting and prospect.
Yeah, and I'm also, maybe I'm a bit stingy, but sometimes when those bills come in, I'm in the Michelin stars, I'm a bit like, oh Christ, how much is this going to cost? And you're drinking wine thinking, I'd like another glass, but I don't want to spend another 30 quid.
I know,
and
glass.
Yeah, yeah. And I start looking at the bills, and if I go somewhere which is reasonably priced, I think, oh, this is so good, I'm going to leave a massive tip. Whereas if I'm in one of those places, I'm thinking, oh God, how much is the service charge on this? Oh no. And I start panicking about how much it's all costing, which is not a good experience for me, but that's maybe because I'm stingy.
I think it's really cool though. You've just got to look at what's going on in food at the moment. I sort of feel like what's happening in restaurants are people are withdrawing from that. I think Michelin in this country is less important than it used to be. And yes, it is still important. And there are still lots of chefs which are achieving these things. But actually, a lot of these chefs are wanting to do really far more relaxed stuff.
Yeah.
I was out with my friend Neil Rankin, who has Temper. He's a big barbecue chef. And we've spent a lot of time in Hackney eating around at all these amazing places. And he was just like, but you know what the frustrating thing is? It's a lot of these new places that are opening that are amazing because they're really good value. They're producing really good food. It just comes down to the simplicity of really, really good quality ingredients cooked really, really well. It's not about technique anymore. And it's true, you know, a lot of this comes down to going to have, you know, a old dairy cow that's been aged really well you know, and having just a really good steak, like the best steak you could possibly find.
And in fairness to Michelin and the Michelin star chefs, a lot of them come on the show, as you know, Sunday Brunch, and they say the same things often. It's like, we're down in Cornwall or wherever we are, we use local ingredients and we forage and we do this and we do that. So they're looking to do that sort of stuff as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, like a great example of that is Tom Brown. He just opened up. He's Nathan Outlaw's ex-head chef at the Capitol, and he's opened up. And, you know, the way he cooks is almost like, you know, the sort of whole sous vide ideal, but it's not. He's cooking everything for real, but he's cooking at such a high quality, high standard, that it's almost like comes across as it being that sort of like sous vide style Michelin, when it's actually, he's bringing back the skill factor of just cooking food really simply but perfectly.
Yeah, we had Tom Kerridge on this podcast.
I love Tom.
He's brilliant, isn't he?
He's my favorite.
Do you know what, the reaction on the Tom Kerridge podcast was absolutely huge. People love him. What I found interesting though is he knew the history of chefs.
Yeah,
and he had the family tree, and he was going through it all with me. Yeah, he knew how who inspired who and who was whose head chef and all that sort of stuff, all the way down. It's really good. But it's a real set, isn't it? So people who work in that industry, that it's, you all know each other,
and
you're all good friends. I'm sure there's some rivalries going on here and
not there. Really, actually, not with the real chefs. I think food writing and stuff, it gets a bit catty.
But it's a community, isn't it? It's definitely. And when you see each other, you all talk and you sort of, it's quite a nice thing, quite a nice industry in that regard.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, I'm lucky in that I've sort of managed to cross over loads of different industries, you know, music and food, and I modeled very briefly. And so I've seen lots of different worlds, was a body piercer as well, weirdly. And when, you know, the industry that is kind of the tightest is definitely cooking.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, but after everything you said there, sorry, this noise going on in the background, I apologise for that. But with everything going on there, the only thing we can really do is go back to body piercing.
I know.
Because that's the bit which struck me.
Yeah.
You were a body piercer.
I was a body piercer. I was a punk. I was a little nightmare. I left school when I was 15. Talking about sort of, I mean, I have ADHD. I've only just sort of found it out in the last few years. But definitely one of the reasons why I left school when I was 15 was because, well, the main reason my father died in my first GCSE. The second reason was because I was very distracted, always. Like, clever, but distracted, and I could never, ever focus. And
explain what ADHD is and explain how you found out you had it.
It's attention deficit hyperactive disorder.
Right.
So it means that it's very, a lot of people have sort of really believed it's quite an Americanism, and it's because it was first sort of really, I don't know where it was first discovered, but it's very much been poignant as part of like what was going on with the young in the States, and that people feel like it's flippantly thrown around. It basically means that you, I mean, I have all of the different afflictions of ADHD as well, and there's three main ones. One of them's hyperactive, one of them's distracted, and one of them is, I can't remember what the third one is. So here we go, that's a classic ADHD, is it?
Right, but we'll Google it quickly for you.
Yeah, the three different types of ADHD.
Yeah.
But part of that is sort of, I get really focused in on one thing. I mean, if you've got my attention, I can give you like 110%. For 1 second, if I'm distracted, then you completely lose me. But I go like tunnel vision in a sort of completely distracted way as well. I'm hyperactive. I'm always moving.
Just shut up, Mark.
Inattentive type.
Yep.
Hyperactive impulsive type.
Yep.
Combination type.
Okay, well, there we go.
What's combination type?
I don't know. Not entirely sure.
What?
Yeah. I feel like there's a third one, but I don't know. Anyway.
oh, I see. Combination of the both.
Yeah, blending them two. Blending
right,
the
okay.
two.
All right.
Anyway, so I'm like always on the go. I have boundless energy, and it's sort of like, you know, you really want to pin me down. You know, I will literally spin around in circles. I'm like a coiled spring.
But how do you find that? How do you find out that's ADHD and not just normal life? Because clearly you think you're normal as you grow up, and then one day you go, oh, you never thought you were normal.
Well, I don't know. Like, I guess there's certain things that come with ADHD, being impulsive. Like, I don't have a second to consider things. I mean, I can get quite angry. This is quite a classic chef thing. I can get really, really angry, and I don't know that I've done it until it's too late.
Right.
So, you know, at school, I would be one of those little dickheads who would fight all the time. And as I've got older, it's definitely affected relationships, you know, and with family and boyfriends and friendships. You know, I don't fight anymore because I'm an adult and I know how to stop that. But I can be as leery. That's the sort of bad side. The other side is the fact that, you know, you can get up and get loads of stuff done.
But if you're impulsive, is that dangerous, like on a night out?
Yeah, it can be dangerous. I don't think I'm like interesting.
Do you wake up the next day thinking, oh, I've done it again?
No, actually not on a night out. I'm quite a good drunk and I'm quite fun like that. I think I'm not the liability mate, I don't think. But I have a lot of, you know, you can be talking to me and you'll lose me. Or I'll suddenly be in the middle of working really hard on something. I'll get up and I'll walk off and I'll start doing something else.
Right.
You know, there's too many things to explain. It's just.
So when was the bit where you, because you said recently you found out you had it. When was the bit where you went, I've got it? Did you go to see someone or?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've had, my father was, we believe, because while he was never officially diagnosed, we still have the same family doctor. We believe he had either like BPD or borderline bipolar. And my sister and I have both been medicated for an acute biological anxiety, which means that it's not a cognitive idea. It's something that we have based on what goes on. You know, it's not circumstantial, our anxiety. It is actually, we don't produce serotonin and dopamine in the same way that other people. It's actually, so we have to be medicated. I've been medicated for the last sort of 13, 14 years.
Really?
And it's brilliant. It's the best thing I ever did. And because of that, mostly I'm fine. But there was still something that was, you know, the anger is still there, or the impulsiveness is still there, or the, you know, the inability to actually follow through with certain projects. Even though I'd be giving it 110% at that moment, I could walk away and suddenly lose complete attention and or a bit of want to even finish it, you know, even though I'd invested like months into doing it, you know. I've been to, God, this is quite deep, but I've been to anger management like three times and just nothing was working. And we've always joked, because I have this boundless energy and bounce all over the place the whole time, and that I have ADHD. It's always just been a running joke.
Yeah, it's one of those things people just go, hey, you got ADHD.
Yeah.
Everyone.
And then I thought, maybe I should actually go and get it checked out. And I thought I might have bipolar, but it turned out I didn't, and I have ADHD.
So what do you do about that?
I was on medication for a while, and it didn't work for me. You know, I'm really happily medicated for anxiety, but I don't have... didn't really fit with the ADHD. It's sort of not, you take it's basically an amphetamine-based drug, and it's actually meant to center you. And actually, it either made me like even more anxious, or it just really like dulled me down, which was part of the reason I think I'm an achiever, is because I have this. So
have you done all the we had Dr. Tamsin Lewis on the other day,
yeah,
and she's big on biomarking, which takes your blood and all your hormones and stuff. I've done the tests, so yeah. I'm due to get them back soon.
Oh, cool.
And you do it all, and then she looks at what you're missing and what's high and what's low. Have you done all those sort of things?
I have a regular, like, really intensive checkup,
oh, that's
like,
good.
With my doctor, but no, I haven't done anything that's so specifically like that, no.
Oh, it's interesting. I'll let you know my results, so I'll maybe get her to
yeah, no, that'd be amazing.
Do some tests on you. Yeah,
but
no,
is it nutritional, then? It's like... She
does her cures, if that's the right word,
yeah.
Or she gives you advice based on then diet,
yeah,
maybe some drugs if you're or supplements or something,
yeah.
And also mental stuff as well, so
yeah. I've since I came off the ADHD medication didn't work, so I was actually, my doctor said, look, there's loads of science to prove now that krill oil is as effective but doesn't give you, it's sort of like has this thing to center your attention. I've been taking that for the last 2 years, and it's amazing.
What is it?
Krill oil.
What's that from?
Krill is, it's basically like plankton, really.
Right.
It's like little
tiny
shrimps.
Whales eat, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I actually, like, only a week ago found out that it is unsustainable. So there's an alternative seaweed that people are looking at that absorbs a lot of the good oils that the krill
Surely they must
eat.
Be able to farm it.
Hopefully, eventually. I mean, I yeah. have to keep taking it. I mean, it is one of those things, actually. Well, I try to eat as sustainably as possible, but, you know, this is something for my health.
It's amazing on this podcast. I interview so many people about health on here. And what we found out recently, 100%, is we're all really different. That's
yeah.
the one thing. And we're all creating different things in us. So everyone's diet should be slightly altered for them.
Absolutely.
And we're all, you know, you and your family will create... Mm. No serotonin, did you say? Or
well,
it's
a bit more complex than that.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's like, yeah.
Whereas I might create too much.
Yeah.
And
totally.
We're all really, but we're, I think we're at the beginning stages of examining it and working
yeah.
out what we are and who we are and how we can look at all everything from our bloods and our hormones and things.
Absolutely. And, yeah. I find that whole thing really fascinating. Like recently, I mean, I've been a real promoter of good gut health. You know, I really think that that's been really, really.
Kimchi.
Yeah, kimchi, exactly. And then a couple of years ago, I went to the Mayo Clinic, which is in Austria. And they said that, you know, I had a really real imbalance in my stomach, which I knew already. But then I started eating loads and loads of probiotics. And I actually think I've made myself worse through eating loads of probiotics.
Oh.
So it's one of those things that nowadays we've got to... You know, it is so unique, you know.
Well, if you've got someone out there who suffers from depression, anxiety, ADHD, we've got a lot of listeners who listen
yeah.
to this, who because I do a lot on this sort of stuff. And what advice would you have for them at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, I think you've got to, like, have a confidence in yourself. Like, no, I've never really had real depression. I've had, like, unbelievable sadness. But depression is a really tricky one for me. I find that really hard to advise on. But... I guess you've just got to just know yourself, and if something feels wrong, you know, go and get it figured out. I do think you need to find some rational in-between bit between real medicine and something a bit more naturopathic,
yeah.
you know, and look and see, you know, look at what you can be doing for yourself naturally that can help, but also do take medical advice because it's
yeah,
important. I mean, therapy doesn't work for me, for example, because it isn't a cognitive problem,
right.
It's a biological one. So I've had loads of therapy and I have a real practical brain. Like I can put things to bed quite easily in my head. It's like, right, done. Whereas, you know, I think there are a lot of people who, you know, I've got this weird sociopathic side of me, I think, that I don't feel jealousy. Like I don't ever... doesn't penetrate me. I could, you know, I have a practical side that if I have a boyfriend that was in front of me seeing another girl, I'd be like, right, that's really not okay. But I don't walk away and
really?
Think, you know, when I'm not with someone, feel jealous. I don't know, it's really weird.
You'd be a great Love Island contestant.
Yeah. I still haven't seen it.
Haven't you?
No, I think I'm like the only person in the country.
Don't watch it because it's one of those things
yeah.
that you get drawn in.
Yeah.
And I watched it because I've got teenage daughters.
Yeah, and so, that old chestnut.
Well, it is. I've watched it all because I think you have to go to them. Teenagers are never going to come to you. So I've watched Dance Moms and RuPaul's Drag Race.
Amazing.
I actually quite like them all. I've got to be honest with you. It's not bad TV at all. It's because we're watching humans, and I quite like watching humans.
Fascinating.
That's why reality works.
Yeah, it's
like,
so
you
true.
Know, you're watching Blue Planet, and everyone goes, "Yeah, that's all right. I love that. It's animals." And then you watch humans, and everyone goes, "You can't watch that," but actually, it's quite nice.
Watching true.
Humans
I've never looked at
flirt
that.
With it. Let's get back to piercings. Talking about humans, we like putting holes in ourselves.
Yeah.
Let's ask the question that everyone out there is thinking: if you're one of the top piercers, did you have to pierce people's bits and bobs?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, so. It was fine. I tell you what. After I did a 3-year apprenticeship, and after like 2 years of piercing ears and navels.
How long?
3 years. It was proper.
3 years to put a hole in someone?
Yes.
How is that? How is 3 years?
Well, because I worked for a studio that really gave a shit about it. You know, they really loved, you know, the whole sort of process of learning. I mean, I went and did an open university course in bloodborne pathology and then human anatomy. And it was, you know, it was really, really important, all those details.
I'm sure when I was a kid, I had my ears pierced. I'm sure the person who pierced my ears.
That's when you go to like Claire's and they shoot a gun into you.
Yeah, that's what I had. I have both my ears pierced and they definitely hadn't been on 3 weeks training course.
No.
3 years,
I must say though, I started my apprenticeship when I told them I was 16, but I was actually 15. And I worked my way. I had to work as a receptionist until I was 17. Then I started training properly. And it was having that grounding is like one of the best things. You know, it was like doing a real apprenticeship. And I learned so much, but mostly I learned about attention to detail and actually really caring about wanting to be the best at something.
So how many piercings would you get through a day?
We did about 12 a day.
We?
Each studio. So each of the studios. So there were like each piercer. There were 3 piercing studios. One of the busiest. It's Cold Steel in Camden. It's still there.
Only 12 a day.
Yeah, because it was half an hour appointments, it was a service. It's a very different
I'm really struggling with this because I just walked into a shop and you pierced my ear. They literally got a gun out.
So when you shoot one of those guns, there's a blood plasma that flies over the gun, right?
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny, tiny one. And you can't really clean it off on the guns because the ones which are disposable aren't strong enough. So they're going to damage the tissue of the skin. And the real ones... they don't care. They're only giving it a wipe with an antiseptic wipe, and that's not doing anything. We would be like using brand new needles, you know, like proper I'm about to say skewers. That's not the right word. You're wrong industry.
Needles. Needles.
No. I can't remember what you call them. They're like
3 years. Jesus. 3 years.
Yeah,
you can't even remember.
It was like 20 years ago. what are they called? Not tongs, but you know where you're
tongs.
I literally can't remember. Anyway, the bits you pinch the skin with.
Oh, yeah.
The bits.
Yeah.
And they, you know, it was, and everything had to be cleaned down properly. The skin had to be cleaned. But it was like a service, like your haircut. It was a much more intricate,
all right, let's
detailed
tell,
service.
Where did you, where was the strangest place you pierced, apart from bits and bobs?
I mean, a lot of the inner ear piercings are really complicated. So like the dyeth, which is this sort of bit here.
Yeah. What was fashionable when you were doing it? Because it was a few years ago. Was it the eyebrow thing happening then?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was when piercing was at its peak, really. So it was, you know, the lip piercings.
Lips.
I mean, I had loads and loads of piercings.
Did you?
Yeah. I only have one left. And I won't tell you who that is. But it's the...
Well, we've all used our imagination now, Gizzy. I'm sorry.
Could be my belly button.
Yeah. People start doing their necks, I've noticed.
Yeah,
the back
I know,
of the
that's
necks.
Really
Did you do that?
At the moment.
Did you do those?
Yeah, that was just as I was leaving.
Right.
They started to come in.
Okay.
They're surface piercings, and often they don't work. They push their way out of the body.
Oh, do they?
Because, you know, most piercings have a lip and a rim, you know.
So, all right. So have you done lots of dick piercings?
If I don't
dicks,
see
lots of dicks piercings. I didn't know really how to say that. What words shall I use? Shall I use penis? Shall I go? Yeah. Shall I go?
The Prince Albert piercing.
Oh, that's
very,
it. That's
very
it.
Popular.
And so, what's
but
that?
So
what's
the,
that
so
experience
like? Hood, like all of them. Were,
okay. What's that experience like for you as the piercer?
I literally couldn't care less. It's like, I mean, it's so English and like silly school humor to be, but like honestly, I really was I love that career, and I was wanting to understand every single part of the body.
Yeah.
And also you build a relationship with your clients. So they're really, you know, a lot, half of the time, these are like really intelligent people who care a lot about body piercing as well, or tattooing, and you know, and there's a whole big scene that was associated with it, you know.
I'm not trying to take it into schoolboy level or whatever, but why do people do it?
What, genital piercings?
Yeah, because I can understand ears, they've been forever, and I can start seeing face because you can see it, but when it's hidden stuff, why do people do it? Is there sexual pleasure out of it?
Yeah, for sure, there is. And then also you have a lot of it is part of the scene. There's a bit of, you know, one-upmanship with your mates. A lot of that, in truth, I think, looking back on it now, is very much to be part of your tribe. And, you know, a lot of people would be, you know, and also a lot of people who are into body piercing ended up crossing over into the sort of fetish scene as well. So, you know... It was like the person who was on our desk. He was the person who owned and launched Torture Garden. So there was a lot of crossing over on that.
Did you ever get surprised? People come, like a lad come in or something, and say, "I want to
get his dick done."
Yeah, or something. Like that. Were there any surprises?
Not really. No, it was always always like our mates, really.
Right. Okay.
Going for that sort of stuff.
Talking about being part of a scene. Were you? You said you were 15 when you started learning this. Were you one of those girls who was out at 15, 16 clubbing and
doing that? Oh my god, 13. I'm a Londoner. I'm from Paddington. And I used to go, I was in the Astoria at Rock Scene, like 13, 14 years old, Slimelight by 15. And then all of the big sort of psychobilly clubs and stuff after that. I was a little nightmare.
So you were into the sort of psychobilly
I was punk really. I was into metal, then got into punk, like proper sort of street punk. Just hang around the Eros, drinking super tea, which was always classy at 14, really nice.
Right.
And then my best friend got pregnant with my godson. And I think like all these psychobilly guys ended up like scooping us up and stealing us away at that stage, because a lot of the street punks were total nightmares. and then after that, like, these guys are still all my mates. So I come from a
town called Rittmansworth, which is out in Hertfordshire, and there's a group of guys there who really got into the rockabilly psychobilly scene. These scups camped all the time.
You used to hang out with loads of people, didn't you?
Well, I used to know loads of them. I wasn't part of that. I was a rude boy, then I turned into a casual. Yeah. I love football and all that sort of stuff. So, but they were so into it, and I always used to be so jealous. They had these amazing haircuts, quiffs, and
flat tops.
Yeah, they were just amazing. How big they got their flat tops and stuff. But they used to. They were really good mates of mine.
Yeah.
I'm still mates with them all now.
But
they used to have so much fun at their gigs.
It's so fun, and
that's the thing. I used to think, I'm really jealous of that. They used to
being part of a tribe again, you know.
It was just amazing seeing all these guys, and they were really into King Kurt.
Love them.
Are you into King Kurt?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And so they used to go to every now and then King Kurt gigs. Now, explain King Kurt for anyone who doesn't know who they are, because they're a mad band, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, King Kurt were, I mean, from the 80s, I guess. I mean, this was still a little bit before my time. I was hanging out with bands like Demented Argo and Klingons and Guanabats and things like that. So, but King, I love King Kurt too. But they, I mean,
what were they called?
It's punk meets
psychobilly,
rockabilly. I guess
they used to get people on stage and cut their hair as part of the gig.
Oh, really? I didn't ever see that.
Yeah, they used to get them on stage and they used to shave their heads off and give them cut. They used to throw flour.
On
the audience and stuff. And then one day I was going down Ricky High Street, and there was all these guys, it was Saturday afternoon or something, and they're all like lads.
Yeah.
But they had all their girlfriends with them as well. But all the guys were wearing dresses. And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
And they went, oh, it's a King Skirt gig tonight.
Amazing.
And all the guys were told to dress up. And so they're all wearing skirts to the gig. And I'm like, you're just having so much fun, all of you.
You'd go to like the Klingons, and they'd all be in like massive nappies, or like a Demented gig, and they'd all be like dressed with like their faces plastered in sort of horror makeup and being all coming off. I mean, it was bananas. It's really hard to explain it to like people who've never really seen it. Google it, I think, is the best.
Yeah, I think so, because it got people going out and having fun. Because these days, it's, I think, you know, if you go to a nightclub, you're either in a nightclub where it's kind of hot and sweaty and it's all about dance house, or it's got one of those clubs with Grey Goose and a rope.
Yeah, same, absolutely.
VIP, which I can't stand either of them, to be honest with you. But those days, it was just really good fun.
It really is. I mean, there's still big club nights, and then also, you know, you got Calea, which is just outside Barcelona, a huge festival every summer, which is amazing. So I went last year for the first time in absolutely ages.
What's that, like a rockabilly thing?
It's a psychobilly on the beach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting psychology that when you're growing up, you want to join something, a be part of something. Yeah. And I'm not sure it's such a big thing now with my children. They don't seem to be part of anything.
I always sort of wonder. I mean, I live in Hackney, so there is still quite a lot of scenes. It's different, and everything, you sort of feel like it's, you know, I mean, I guess it took me a while to sort of find where I was comfortable as a teenager, and that sort of ended up being the sort of punk psychobilly rockabilly thing. But, you know, what you notice nowadays is it's so trend-led. There's like 18 months being into this, 18 months being into that, and it keeps going as people get into adulthood.
But it all crosses over. So if you speak to my kids, they'll like indie music, they'll like hip-hop, R&B. And I'm like, well, when we were kids, we were only allowed to like what was part of our scene. You know, I hated the Smiths because I was like, I can't like the Smiths because I'm into jazz funk, man. You know, and then latterly you start, because I always worry when people say they're really into the Smiths when they're younger, because I was always like, okay, right, I kind of understand that, but you can't be doing that fashion and that. And then and then later on you start listening to Smith, you go, wow, amazing. But you weren't allowed to. Yeah.
That's such a nice thing about, you know, growing up and being able to sort of observe all of that, and then, you know, even like the stuff my sister loved, because she loved the Smiths, you know, without, like, my sister's 4 years older than me, and I guess that's why I got into rock and roll, was because she was really into things like Guns N' Roses. But then obviously I had to be the person to push those boundaries. But now, like, me and my big sister go to like all the same gigs together.
That's good.
Which is really great, whereas we would never have done that as teenagers.
I've still not listened to Guns N' Roses and thought, wow, that's so good.
It's so good.
I don't think so.
It's so good.
Did you DJ doing it as well?
There was a club, in Elephant's Head in Camden, which is the pub we all used to go to. And I used to help put sort of records and sleeves with a lot of the DJs. And that was kind of from 15. And then, I mean, I just love music. And I've always had that was more with rockabilly though. So I guess later on, I got really into DJing rockabilly. And still do, actually. But it's quite weird, like nowadays.
I assume if you DJ rockabilly, you're DJing 7 inches, but you're probably not, are you?
Not anymore, because they're so valuable. You can't, you know, I mean, I am... part of my condition is I'm the biggest klutz, you know, and you start trashing records that are that valuable, and it's a travesty. And actually nobody really wants you to DJ vinyl anymore, because the access to be able to, you know, I mean, I still haven't quite got up to having like one of those things you plug into the side of your your decks, but I
had the most amazing night one night. I was a charity thing, and Suggs was that's where I bought my schooning out there, but and Suggs was doing it. It was pancreatic cancer, which was sadly my brother died of, and we were having a good drink, and Suggs went, do you want to come back to my house? I was like, yeah. And then we went downstairs and he got vinyl out and was doing playing old Scar on vinyl.
Amazing.
So it's got the the crackle, and I was like, this is
so good.
And I turned to my mate Phil and went, this is the best night of my life.
I bet.
I was a bit drunk though. So. Okay. So how did you get into cooking then? From doing all that and being the body piercer and all that sort of stuff, you went and trained really hard, didn't you?
Yeah. So I first, I think I got to the point where I'd been piercing for 7 years. Loved cooking. I mean, I've always cooked. My mum's a brilliant cook. We were in, she spent a lot of time in Thailand growing up. So, and I kind of like was really interested in ingredients. And I think there's kind of an inherent thing of my sisters don't eat that well. I mean, they eat. But, you know, I eat everything.
Right.
And so as an eater, my mum, who loves food and eats everything, she'd always be like, you know, put anything in front of me and I'd eat it. She'd be like, oh, you're really amazing. You're amazing. You're amazing. And I'd be like, yes, there's one thing I'm great at is eating. From a very young age, suddenly this became a bond. She moved to Thailand well, she was in Thailand like 70% of the year, and we were schooled in London. And I just wanted to be able to cook the food that she did. So we'd phone each other up all, like, while she was away, and she talked me through. It was like a really nice bonding thing. So that's sort of how it went early on. I moved out, would go to bed with cookery books because I'd make something really nice for dinner, and I'd be like, right, I'm going to do something just as good tomorrow at 17, 18 years old. And then, you know, and before I knew it, this was like my actual sort of, like, these were becoming my Bibles, I guess. I'd read read these before bed rather than literature. We would go, yeah, we'd have the best, I don't know, then like I got to the point where I wanted to cook, went and met a friend of mine who had a restaurant group called, was Will Ricker. He had a restaurant called E&O, which was in Notting Hill at the time.
It's still there.
Yeah, it's still there. And he's like, come and work with me for a bit. It was Ian Pengelly was the chef, and do a little stagio. So I did work experience there. Loved it. And he was like, okay, if you love it, then just go to catering school. So I did. And then ended up doing like loads of stagios around the world, actually. And then worked at one of my favorite restaurants still for a bit. And then I ended up winning a big intern prize to go and work for BBC Good Food magazine. So so that was kind of about a 3-4 year process of getting there and then getting into cookery writing and then the pop-ups and stuff.
But when you were working at Leith's, you were still doing the piercing, were you?
Yeah, I was.
So yeah. You were doing school during the day?
School 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So that'd be like 9 to 5. Then you'd have 2 hours of coursework. I'd do a stage in the evening. So I'd be working in a restaurant in the evenings. And then on the weekend, 2 days piercing. And I ended up getting like evicted. I was working so hard and I couldn't, you know, and I wasn't earning enough money. I got evicted. It's like absolute, like the best time of my life meets the worst, you know. But then my teacher, or the person who actually ran the whole school, Caroline Waldegrave, who bought the school off Pruleith, ended up giving me money back so I could afford to stay at catering school. So yeah, without her, I wouldn't have been able to have done that. What you're looking at?
I'm just looking around. I've got a Leith's book there. For anyone who doesn't know what Leith's is, it's kind of the premier.
Leith's book,
yeah, right? Look, the one on the right hand side next to the one that says bar. Yeah, I'd never look at it. I just have it there. But Leith's are just, they're the one, aren't they? The school.
I mean, I think in the UK, I mean, unless you're going to go to Westminster, which is a 3-year proper chef's course. Leith's for me is the best catering school probably in the world. I think it's fantastic. It's, you know, it's, I'm really, I was really spoiled to be able to go there. It's private and I was lucky, and you know, my grandmother left me a very small inheritance. It wasn't enough to get me all the way through school, but it was enough to kind of get me in through the door. And I mean,
because I think that could be, I think you alluded to it earlier, that people just think, oh, look, she looks good and she probably did a couple of pop-up restaurants, so stick her on TV. Yeah. But you did actually, it was it still is a huge passion of yours, isn't it?
Yeah, oh no, totally. I'm the biggest geek.
Yeah.
I'm saying, you know, earlier on talking about ADHD, part of my thing is I get fixated, and with cookery it's a fixation. Like I need to know every detail about it. I did a show a while back with Richard Corrigan called Cookery School.
He told me off.
Did he?
He told.
I deserved it.
He was on the show. It was really funny. I got a fork or something I was mixing, and I went dun 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 on the side of a glass bowl.
Yeah.
And he went, it's really funny. He just went, don't do that, like that. Turn around, shouted at me, and I was like, what?
Oh,
and
my God.
And he goes, you do not hit metal on glass. And I was like, yeah, of course you don't. But it was on TV.
Yeah, but you just like, oh my God. Like,
I've been told off. He's a very, very good man, isn't he? Very
he
good.
He is amazing. Yeah. And do you know what? It was like, that was my first introduction to like that big caliber of cook. And I think, you know, we had to double up. And I think when we first met, he was like, oh, great, I've just got this like dolly bird I've got to work with. And within about like 2 days, he was like, do you know what? I don't need to say anything technical. You know more than me. And I'm like, what? But actually, you know, and that's how he introduced me to everyone. He introduced me to Mark Hicks, to Angela Hartnett, to all these people. And like since then, because I am that geek who does claim to know everything, I want to know everything. And that's the thing. You know, they were all kind of taking me under their wing and giving me like the thumbs up and the respect that I think I still struggle with myself to whether I do or don't deserve.
Yeah. Well, what makes a good chef though? Because we can all sit here and go, let's put pigeon with celery and snails. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, any old nonsense.
For me, it's a combination of technique, but also it's like it's a cliche of like going to, you know, people have to cook with their heart. They really need to be involved in the actual food. They need to understand how it cooks, but also understand about seasoning and flavor. And, you know, that to me is a rarity. So often I see a lot of chefs who can technically produce beautifully cooked food, but it doesn't mean it has that sort of heart and soul and the body that you really want when you eat something. You know, I feel like often I might not have had, you know, I might be out of practice technically, actually, you know, because of what a lot of the chefs are doing nowadays. There's a lot more technology. You know, I've only ever sous vide something once, and, you know, but I actually do think that I can cook things properly, and I really have a good palate, and I really care about how it comes out, and not just on the search for perfection on technical stuff, but the whole experience, you know?
I hate asking this question because I always have to remind Simon it's not, but do you think cooking is an art? I always start talking about that and go, no, it's not, Simon. It's not an art. You're not an artist.
I mean, there are real arty cooks, you know. Yeah. A lot of these people produce... I mean, look, you've got to look at Rene Redzepi from Noma. His food, it looks like art. There's no getting away from it. I'm not sure, and I love Rene to bits, that I want to eat it all the whole time. That's the difference. It's so creative. It's so, you know, brilliantly put together. That doesn't necessarily mean it's delicious. I mean, some of my
Sorry to interrupt you. It's a one-off, isn't it? Mm. Whereas I suppose the sort of food you want to do is where people go, I'm coming back every week.
Exactly.
I want to eat at Gizzy's restaurant.
Absolutely. And, you know, there is the theatre. You know, and there's a cute... You can't knock, I mean, the respect for people like that. There are people who get it really right on both parts. I mean, I think... Massimo Bottura, he's a great example, you know. And then you've got somebody who actually, he's cooking Italian food and really, you know, I learned loads from him actually. I worked with him in London when he was here a few years ago. And, you know, even trying to like, looking at how he made his brodo, his stocks were, you know, everything from the sea. So he'd put, you know, seaweed in it all the way through to going up to the top of the hill, which would be the dairy, the sort of the old dairy cows. Yeah. He'd use the bones from that. And, you know, from the vegetables all the way up. And it was just like such a great analogy of how you look at building the perfect, most roundest, brilliant umami-based stock. And I just, you know, and that is genius because it comes from a really heartfelt place, you know. So, you know, we've all got loads to learn off each other, you know. I think that's the great thing. And that, isn't it great? It's like, it's really subjective as well, like art. So, you know, you might love a certain style of cooking, to, you know, and I might disagree with you. You might go to Noma and go, it's the best meal I've ever had. And I you know, for me, it was fascinating.
No, I do. Like,
great theatre, but just not delicious.
Yeah, I like restaurants which are busy and I like restaurants which have a good atmosphere.
I agree.
And there's an Indian restaurant down the road from me here, which we all go to around here because it does authentic Indian food. It's sort of like railway curry, railway mutton curry. And, you know, strange things like where the curry's left on the bone and you know, the meat's left on the bone and stuff. And you're like, it's just
proper.
Or it's just, I don't know.
It's probably family home cooking. It's not like the classic English, you know, I might be, interpretation.
Yeah, I might be being conned, but it feels that way. So I love it.
But also, you've just got to trust, you know, that eating comes down to, you know, I said ages ago, like probably the best meal I've ever, ever, ever had was making a sausage sandwich in an aga with really chewy white bread, loads of thick country butter, wrapping it in foil and going down to the beach to eat it and watch the sunset. I mean, that was like the most perfect moment with, you know, the best sausages, the best butter, the best bread, you know, Heinz ketchup. It's like, a bit of brown sauce.
Is it unfair to ask you which restaurants you would go to eat out?
I mean, I love, there's so many I love, you know. I think at the moment, I'm really into, I mean, my best restaurant in London is a restaurant called Brawn, and it's in Columbia Road. And it just gets everything right. It's so chill. It's, you know,
what sort of food is it?
It's small sharing plates, but just everything's really beautifully sourced and cooked. It's the sort of classic Hackney thing, really good natural wines, really good vibe. It's kind of brasserie bistro feel. It's really relaxed and it's always buzzy. Wow. God, where else do I love? There are so many places I love. I literally can't think. I haven't left my restaurant for so long.
What are the latest food trends then? You talked about you're doing some barbecue food and stuff like that. That's smoked food and barbecue food. That's big in the East London, isn't it? Is that big?
Not really in East London. Isn't it? It's sort of... I mean, Neil Rankin and Dave Smokestack, who they're like the two people that I would really credit for those that being so great. I mean, we're doing a really good pop-up, actually. The guys from Fetty Sow in New York, Best Brooklyn Barbecue, are coming over to pop-up at Main Street in a month. And that's really exciting. Because, again, that's quite... It's a real skill, barbecue. It really is. It's not like, you know, in England, we sort of think putting something on a grill is barbecuing. In America, it's hot smokers that are a little bit... that things are cooked low and slow, and they get a char because of the smoke, not because of... and slightly because of the temperature, but not because you're actually charring it against fire. So, you know, I love that. Do you know what? One of the best places to eat in London, and I'm not just saying this, it's probably somewhere like going to somewhere like Street Feast. Dinerama, you go there, amazing, amazing booze, amazing, you know, really good vibes. And then loads of stalls of, you know, the best chicken wings, the best barbecue, the best pizzas and stuff.
So what else you do? You told me earlier, but before we started filming, that you're going to be working with Rosemary Ferguson and Jake Chapman. What are you doing with those two?
Well, we already did. I mean, Jake's only we've an added bonus because he's married to Rose. But yes. me and Rosemary are we've started a brand called Pure Filth, and it's these vegan it's vegetarian burgers. Actually, I'm going to call them vegetarian. We've gone into it more from an ethical and a health point of view. We messed around about 18 months ago making these sort of, we wanted to make some really cool vegetarian burgers. And by complete accident, we've made these things, these burgers, which are really, they're not, I don't know if you've been following what's been going on in Silicon Valley with Microsoft. Bill Gates has invested loads of money in this thing called the Impossible Burger. And it's a burger that bleeds, but it's actually vegetarian. You should try get it on the show, actually. It's really interesting. So it chars like meat. But it actually bleeds, but it's completely vegan.
Right.
And they've spent millions, maybe even billions, in producing this. And I saw this and I was just thinking, you know, this is the future of food. This is the thing that's going to save us when we can't eat any more meat, because it is a real problem, you know.
Yeah, but I think that we can, I did a little mini documentary on it once, we can produce meat now in test tubes, basically, like artificial meat, artificial protein. So so we can do that.
That
so
sounds delicious. Well, I know, but it's going to say, I mean...
Yeah, but so is like a vegan substitute. You've got to find, you've got to find the flavours to put in it.
But we've also got to understand what the, there will be a million problems that come with that. First of all, what is the nutritional content of a meat that gets grown in test tubes?
Well,
I mean, is it going to be the same as something that's been brought up drinking, eating grass and, you know...
Who knows, but we could
probably
potentially...
Probably not.
We could potentially make it out of human protein, and then it would be very... it's kind of...
That's weird. Where did that come from?
A bit cannibal.
Don't know if that's going to take off.
That came from my dark moments. No. But there's a potential we can do that.
Does it not make more sense that we all start to recognize that we overconsume meat simply, and that we actually individually know that if we were cutting back and eating higher quality meat and less of it and eating more vegetable protein, that the world would be a much happier place, and we might not need to get to that level?
I think the demand is phenomenal for meat, and I think the demand is phenomenal. I think we're gonna have to make it.
But you talk about food trends, the biggest food trend at the moment is veganism, and there is no shadow of a doubt that this is not just
tough to
this
do,
is not just a trend.
It's tough to live your life like that.
I couldn't do it. I mean, I eat probably 50% vegan food in the week. If I'm cooking at home, I'll eat vegan, because
I've had fantasies about doing it, but I can't be bothered.
It's quite hard because it's more than a lifestyle.
It's a challenge.
But you don't have to do it every day.
Right.
You know, like, isn't a beautiful tomato salad really delicious? Or like tomato pasta, or like, you know, really, you don't have to like have a blockage that meat isn't fulfilling.
No, but you need your protein, don't you? It's one of the most important things.
Vegetable protein's really good as well, you know?
Yeah.
We also presume that the meat protein is the one. I mean, the burger we've developed has more protein in it than beef, you know? It tastes... as soon as we're ready, I'm going to actually come and I'm going to make you come down and eat one.
Well, I want to,
And it acts...
Oh, no, I'm not anti it at all. I'm just saying that I think... man-made protein is going to be absolutely huge, made in a laboratory.
That's what they're already doing, but man-made animal protein or man-made actual protein.
man-made animal protein.
Yeah, I mean, I still, that makes me feel weird.
They took cows and they did that, and then they found that fish is really easy to make. But the price has come down dramatically now, so it's becoming it's becoming a viable option to get fish protein made really, really easily, and then maybe we'll make human protein to eat.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait. Like, you'll be the first in line.
Something I read not so long ago is, do you know why British food is so bland?
Why?
This is good there. It's apparently one of the theories behind it is our ingredients are so good that we didn't have to spend ages masking the flavours like they had to do in, say, hot climates where the meat can get...
Yeah, absolutely.
So they have a lot much more flavoursome
food because of the spices and everything. Oh, no, I mean, I think that's quite...
So if you take that theory of my man-made human protein, right? Okay. Let's just call it... animal protein. You've got animal protein, you've got a block of it, and you say it might be tasteless because it's not been eating grass and all that sort of stuff. Fair enough. But then once you've got, you know, you've given it to Gizzy in a kitchen, and she's got a chili on it and a paprika and a bit of garlic here and a something. It's fried up with some onions. Everything starts with an onion, and you fry it up without that. And then you know you've got some lovely stuff there. Then suddenly you've just got a kind of like tofu. Really, you're just gonna.
Well, you say that, like, I don't know. I mean, I've been. Have you heard of seitan?
Oh, yeah, he's not a nice bloke.
you might meet him if you get more into human protein.
I'm going down. I'm not going up when I die. Yeah. God, what's seitan?
Seitan is like, it's very trendy at the moment, particularly in Hackney. It's a protein. It actually came, I believe it was, it was made in Asia. It's a wheat gluten. It's made almost like a dough. And then it's poached. It's flavored with vegetable stock often. It's poached, it's cut into bits, and then it's fried like steak. It's like fried chicken nowadays. It's put into, you know, mock duck is seitan. You know, there's loads of vegan things. And for me, I've tried really hard to get into it, and it's absolutely disgusting, no matter what you do with it. And it's so trendy, and everyone is trying to tell me that this is a good, viable source, but it tastes horrific.
The one thing I worry about, and I don't want to knock vegan stuff because, you know, I think it's fantastic. I'm not in any side on this huge war going on between meat and plant-based diets and stuff like that. But sometimes I look at the vegan stuff and I think, wow, there's a lot of ingredients in that.
And
as soon as you get more than a couple of ingredients in something, I think, well, the alarm bells start going. They're trying to make that stuff.
Absolutely.
You get a lamb chop, it's lamb. You get broccoli, it's broccoli. You know, that's kind of where I feel.
You know, you know that even with meat product that happens. You know, I agree with you. And I totally, you know, from actually making faux proteins, I think that is naturally going to happen. You know, you have to put flavor in it and stabilizers often. You know, it's the stabilizers that get put in that are at these sort of weird ingredients. I think,
what is a stabilizer?
It's often something simple like a tapioca flour or xanthan gum or something, but you know, it can actually get really chemical as well.
So, anyway, I'm into your burgers. So when's that happening, and what's Jake doing?
Jake, we did a pop-up in the Tate. Sold out like 1,000 tickets a day, which was amazing for like 3 weeks. And he made these McDonald's Unhappy Meal boxes, which were unbelievable. I'll see if I can find, I think I might have a spare one. I'll see if I can hunt one out for you.
She's, for anyone who doesn't know, Rosemary Ferguson, would you call her a supermodel?
She was a supermodel. She's an unbelievable creature.
She was, fantastic. She was hanging out with, in the same era as Kate and all that, like Kate Moss and all those guys. And so she's,
she's a nutritionalist.
Yeah, she's moved into
But she's a real nutritionist. You know, I've been sort of really vocal about how much I hate the whole clean eating movement. The thing about Rose is that she is of such a high caliber that she's actually working with Ulster University to set up the new, the traffic light system on the back of food, you know, to make it where oily fish and, you know, nuts and avocados don't come too high because they have so much fat in them because it's good fat. You know, she's really very clever woman.
Right.
She know, you know, she's like an encyclopedia. Yeah. Throw a vegetable at her, not literally.
No.
And she can tell you exactly what's in it.
And she's good fun as well. Do you know?
We met at a party.
Did you?
Yeah.
Shock.
And part of the reason
we met at a party when we were 14.
Part of the reason we sort of did the brand was because we were like, we want to just get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how can we have a really good time and then still be healthy? Yeah.
Do you know her twin as well? Yes. Ed, he's lovely as well,
isn't he? Yeah. Oh, you really do know her then?
I used to hang out with Ed all the time. Yeah. I used to play golf with him. He used to smash me all over the
place.
Oh,
really?
He's a very good golfer. Anyway, let's move on to some... what else you've got coming up? Have you got anything else coming up? Have you got any more books or are you doing any more TV? Or
I got my next book is coming out in autumn. It's called Slow. And this is like the book that I've been really waiting for, you know. It's the first book that I'm not going to be on the cover for, which I'm really pleased about because, you know, as much as, you know, I've never really sort of seen myself as the person that needs to be on the cover of a cookbook. And this, it's really, the book sort of talks about slow cooking, which is, I guess, first and foremost what it's about. But it also talks about sort of slow growing your veg and, you know, understanding the terrain that things are grown in and how things are evolving. So it definitely won't include sort of dish made proteins. but it's really good. It's my best book I've written by far, and it's good because I've got to actually really get to really write, like properly write. It's not just about writing recipes,
so you
it's
have to
talking
do...
about like the journey of what it takes to make a brilliant tomato.
When's
like,
that out?
It is out in October, I believe.
So you're gonna have to start doing lots of TV around that.
I am.
So you're gonna be back in, gonna come back on Sunday brunch and everything.
Yeah, I get terrified on Sunday brunch.
Do
I
really you?
Because I, one, I swear a lot. Two, I just don't, I'm not naturally good on telly.
Oh,
I'm
you
fine
are.
Like this.
You are.
I talk too much and you I just are. Get discombobulated and I forget what I'm doing.
No, the viewers like you.
Oh, thank you.
I think that's half the battle.
God, do you remember last time I was on when Suggs like totally stitched me up?
No, was Suggs on it?
Yeah.
Suggs is always a good guest.
Yeah, I love him. Somebody, I can't remember what happened, but somebody said something. Swore and it was him, and then you made me apologize for swearing, and I was like, pretty sure I didn't swear.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Down my ear, I was TV's so bizarre because there was someone swore, and then down my ear, it's like, someone swore, get Gizzy to apologize, and you went, I'm sorry, and it was like, look around. And everyone's going, like, she didn't swear. And everyone was like, it's so bizarre. The thing is with TV, I'm going to let people behind the curtain now. When Ofcom tell you off, the first thing you have to do is prove that you apologize as a TV show.
Yeah.
So the annoying thing is when anyone swears and no one knows what a swear word is anymore, because there's, I mean, we obviously know the bad ones, but there's a bit in between, like, what was it about?
Crap, for example.
Yeah,
or
bloody or something. You know, that bloody potato or something like that. Or you know, and the Americans come on and say shit, and or they say, what do they say? There's one they
shoot.
Always... No, there's always one they say, and then you don't, but you've got to apologize immediately. Someone said bastardize on our show, and then in my ear they went apologize.
Why? I'm thinking, really intellectual
thinking
way.
I can't apologize. That's a proper word, isn't it?
No,
so I went, I'm sorry for that word, I think. And then afterwards, all the viewers were like, Lovejoy, such an idiot. You apologize for a word which isn't a swear word. I'm like, I don't know. You know, they were telling me in my ear, just apologize. Stop getting us in trouble.
Also, it is so impulsive, that kind of thing, that you've just got to keep going, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't mind. Who's offended by an accidental swear word? If you get someone just swearing constantly, that could probably be quite vulgar. All right, let's ask you the questions that we ask everybody that comes onto the show. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Be yourself. I think every time I've tried to second guess something, it's always fallen horribly wrong. And, you know, I think, you know, whoever you are is the most interesting version of you, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a problem years ago where I sort of, when I first started doing telly and people, you know, I had this time I had like sides of my head shaved and big sort of quiff and like I'm really tattooed. And, you know, so everyone's like, you know, tidy yourself up. This, you're never going to get anywhere like that. And actually, that's been part of my job. And the thing that's actually made me break through, I guess.
You see, you only see you once and you remember you. That's the thing. No, that is because you were so different coming through the chef world. And for us to see, it was like, it was exciting. What's the biggest mistake you've made?
Had an affair. Never gonna forgive myself.
So we've done that on the podcast, right? We did this. It was really funny. Mark and I, this the precursor to this podcast, we used to do we're still doing it actually in a way. I do advice column. I give people advice. And one day we were discussing advice and Mark said, The problem with an affair is it just seems like a lot of, what was your word? A lot of admin. So then someone wrote in and told us all about their affair. You can, by the way, if you're listening to this or watching this, it's an old podcast, you can listen back to it. So someone wrote in and talked about how he had an affair. He ended up living in a caravan from being a lovely family in France. Then some woman wrote in saying that she was someone that had an affair on. And that, and then she said how it destroyed their lives. And then another woman wrote in, none of these people are connected. And she said, I was the woman in the middle. And we read out all their things. But all three of them, different affairs and stuff, but they all their lives were destroyed from an affair. It's like,
it's the worst. And it is, you know, I'm very lucky in that, you know, the person I had an affair with, we sort of moved back. We didn't go out, but we had property together. So we're living together at the moment. And it has been forgiven, but my God, I haven't forgiven myself still, and it still beats me up. And you mess people's lives up. It's horrific for something so
ridiculous.
You know.
All right, any life hacks? Maybe travel tips or something, or whatever. Cooking.
You know, I don't really like the hacking. I like to see things through properly. Right. So I'm not really somebody who's going to be, you know, here's a cheat way of doing something. I don't necessarily think you should cut corners. So
do it properly.
I'm skipping out on that one.
All right. what's it like being famous?
Weird. I feel like at the moment I don't feel that famous, which is great. I was in, you know, I went out with somebody quite well known, and one of my best friends is very famous. And, you know, there was a moment during the breakup of that I absolutely was the most uncomfortable time of my life. And I think a lot of that had to do with me withdrawing myself from doing what I was doing back then as well.
What do you mean uncomfortable? Because people were reporting on it?
Oh, I mean, I was on holiday getting phone calls from journalists, big journalists in the UK, and, you know, knowing bits about my life that was just like, how on earth do you even know this? And, you know, I it's not something that sits very well with me. I'm a cook. I love cooking, and I don't really want to be in the Daily Mail. Thank you very much. So I think pretty much since then I withdrew from going to parties, from, you know, I mean, I still have very good friends who are famous, and we still have a great normal life together. But being famous is not important to me, and being successful is. You know, I want to be good at my job.
Yeah. Make sure you have a purpose. That's the important thing. Absolutely. Okay. What is the meaning of life?
Oh, crikey. I don't know, that makes my head cave in all the time. I think about this a lot. Evolution, seeing where we're going to be getting, like understanding where we've come from. I don't know, like seeing, it is all about evolution, and like, I don't necessarily feel entirely procreating, but see, I mean, where is this going to end, actually? It's like with how technology is advancing, the fact that we understand so much about where we've come from. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Do you think about it a lot?
I do think about this
a lot. Yeah, so do I. I spend a lot of time listening to podcasts and thinking about it a lot. I have no conclusions for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's like that. You've got philosophical ideas. You've got scientific ideas. There's like, and then the second you think too much about it, then my head just caves in.
One thing I do spend a lot of time doing now is thinking about death.
Do you?
Yeah, and I think it's important to do that.
Get yourself psyched for it.
Just know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, every day the sun's going to come up and one day you're going to die. And that's kind of the way it is in our lives as we can imagine it. And when we die, it means that you can then look at every day and go, I'm going to die, so this is what I've got left here.
Mm.
See, what I think life would be so much better. You know, when people go, oh, I'm 50 years old. Mm. That's sort of the irrelevant fact. The relevant fact is how long I've got left, but no one can tell me that.
Oh, no, I don't even think it's like that. It's like, what have you achieved in that time? You know, it's like, are you using that time you've been given to the best of your advantage? You know, like, what are you going to stand for? So I read something the other day that was really cool.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, so, I mean, I'm not religious particularly, but I think that there's sort of like big ideologies that I can understand. And they were saying, what is actual hell? And hell, if you looked at it, is hell being the thing that your people remember you as. Are you going to be remembered as being a good person or a bad person?
Yeah.
And if you're remembered as a bad person, then you're in hell. And I don't, if you've stood for something.
Hell is a fake protein called Satan.
That is true.
That's what helped. Okay, so if you're,
if you're slightly
religious, then is there an afterlife?
I'm not that religious. I think spiritual is kind of like a better way of looking at it.
Is there an afterlife?
Again, I think about this a lot. No, I don't think there is. I think that we have realms that we are, you know. God, this is a big conversation. This is going to involve a few drinks. I think that there are different realms that we sort of fit. We can feel things spiritually within those realms, if that makes sense. So, but I don't think that there is necessarily an afterlife. I think we can live on spiritually, but I don't know if that's...
So what's the point then?
What's the point?
Yeah.
Because life's brilliant, no? I mean, I like having a great time.
It's like a theme park. It's like going to...
It's like a theme park. Yeah, exactly.
Earth's a theme park.
Absolutely. Just enjoy yourself.
We've just got a few years here.
Absolutely. And have the best time. And yeah, I mean, it's a nightmare a lot of the time.
And we're a sweaty coach.
I know. God. You're a barrel of laughs.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really apologize about that present. It looks ridiculous.
I'll take a picture of it when it's
But you can hang it somewhere because it's got a little handle on it.
Cool.
But I'm actually going to just hold that up. Mark, can you just hold that up at that one of those cameras so people can see how cheap I am? There you go. That's what it is. So, if people want to follow you, where do they go?
I'm best on Instagram, thank you. So Gizzy Erskine on Instagram. Also Mare Street Market.
Mare Street Market.
For food.
Come down there, have some fun with this, and thanks so much for doing the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was really, really nice. I feel like we've spoken for hours and hours and hours. I kind of want to drink now and carry on.
Discuss it. I've got to interview Johnny Vegas.
I know. Johnny's like...
You're a mate of his, aren't you?
Yeah, I love him to bits.
He's such a nice guy, isn't he?
We've done like a couple of pilots for TV shows together, and like we've got another two in production, so hopefully that will happen one day.
What, with him?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm going to ask him about it. Or are you not allowed to say?
I don't know.
I better not.
I don't know. We did one ages ago with Jonathan Ross. It was really cool.
Oh, that would be cool.
But I didn't ever get commissioned. So, yeah, that's the other part of TV. How much stuff do you do that doesn't ever see the light of day?
That's why I love online stuff, because I say to you, do you want to come and do a podcast? You say, yeah, you chip up here, we turn on the cameras and we go, listen to it. TV, you've got to go, let's go through 16 different layers of management and also we'll do it in 6 months' time. Yeah. It's like, really?
And you're really good at this part of it as well. So
thank you very much. Excellent. Thank you very much. See you soon. So that was Gizzy. She's such a lovely person. Really enjoyed that. Mark, have you got any piercings?
No.
Have you ever had any piercings?
No piercings, no tattoos.
Have you ever...
I always worry that if I had a tattoo, you know when they stamp pork? I reckon that's what I'd look like.
Have you ever...
Is that a really horrible image?
Bizarre image. Have you... I'm imagining you naked now. Have you ever contemplated having a piercing?
No.
Contemplated a tattoo?
My friends... No, never. My friends, when we went to Reading Festival when we were 15, they disappeared for a bit and they all came back with their ears pierced, and I laughed.
Well, I had two big hooped earrings.
Like a pirate.
My dad one day said, are you going out dressed as a pirate?
Oh, he said that?
Yeah, because there was a stage where we were sort of wearing bandanas around our head as well. So I bandana... And two hooped earrings. And my dad just laughed and went, are you dressed as a pirate? I'm like, no. But my funniest one was I was in a doctor's waiting room. And this kid was banging this truck against me. And I had long hair at the time as well. I had really long hair.
Dreads?
No, I had really kind of like a mullet-y thing. I had really long hair and I had my two big hooped earrings. And this little boy was going bang, bang, bang. And this woman said, could you stop banging that man with your truck? And the little kid looked at me and went, Mummy, that's not a man, it's a woman. Which just made me laugh so much.
Tina Lovejoy.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that's it from this week's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. As I say, you can watch these if you want to. Go to YouTube, search for Dear Lovejoy, or you go to my Twitter page and we'll put it up there. Or we'd probably run it on the bottom of this podcast.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Put the link. So, let us know what you think. If you're watching them, and we'll see you all soon with another podcast. Bye.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.